Good evening.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon. The purpose of tonight's seminar, this afternoon seminar, is to discuss some of the halachos of Choshen Mishpat, some of the halachos that apply to our day-to-day business activities. There was a time in America where concepts like Shabbos or Shatnez and similar halachos, they weren't understood, they weren't discussed, and people had a perception that you couldn't live life. You couldn't run a successful business if you were Shomer Shabbos. Over time, Baruch Hashem, these ideas and these perceptions have changed. Today, Choshen Mishpat is in a very similar situation. These laws are not discussed, they're not well understood, and people have a perception that if you look and ask too many questions and you follow these halachas too carefully, the fear is that you simply won't be able to run a business effectively. The purpose of the Mechon and the purpose of tonight's shir is to address these issues, to deal with the halacha issues and questions that do come up, and to provide practical guidance on how to keep your business dealings consistent with halacha. And as we'll see, if there's a little knowledge and there's a little caring, enough to ask in advance, just that everything can be structured and done in a manner that's consistent with halacha. One of the challenges that the Mechon has in arranging these events is that the topics that we deal with, topics such as ribbis, are one of the most complicated areas in halacha. And even among rabbanim, there are many people who are reluctant to answer questions because of the complexity of these halachas. Aside from the complexity of the halachic end, the issues that we deal with over here, when we're dealing with finance, when we're dealing with hedge funds, just simply to understand the legal and the economic structure of these deals takes an expert as well. To have a speaker who's able to deal and master both parts of the equation, who's both a Talmud Chacham and a Mumchah in these halachas, and has a deep understanding of the laws and the structures of these investments, is truly unique. And it's certainly an honor and a kavod for us to call upon Rav Leich to address the audience.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for an overly generous introduction. Rabbi Cohn, Moira Rabbi Yisrael. I was asked to speak about problems of interest in ribbis, and I was told I have half an hour. I know a little bit of how to talk about kol ha-Torah kula al-halachas, but I don't know how to talk about even Hilchos Ribbis in half an hour. That's too long to do it in one succinct sentence and not enough time to do justice to the topic, but I'll try. The basic area is one that today is a subject upon which a lot of people are focusing attention, having nothing to do with people in this room, nothing to do with us, the Jewish community, the observing Jewish community, but because of the rise of Islamic banking. I have received inquiries over the course of the past several years from people involved in Islamic banking asking, and what did the rabbis do in order to avoid the problems? A paper that I will never write would have the title Islamic Banking, What Jewish Law Would Look Like If the Sages of the Talmud Had Not Plugged the Loopholes. They engage in a series of very innovative devices in order to overcome the technicalities of money lending and taking interest in return for money lending, chief of which, at least classically, and they're looking now for other things, including a heteroska, which intrigues them, was a repro agreement. You sell a piece of property and agree to buy it back 6 months or a year later at a stipulated price, which is higher than the original purchase price. So in effect, you've got a loan which is repaid at a later time, and it's repaid with a premium, and that premium is a kind of a subterfuge for what is really interest. That would be entirely permissible as far as biblical law is concerned, because there's no loan. There's only an agreement to repurchase. It's a commercial agreement, one agreement for another agreement, but Chazal understood that this was a subterfuge, and clearly it was. And they proceeded to ban it and lots of other things that could come to mind readily. I would be remiss if I were to plunge into the halachas of ribis and the heterisk as a way of overcoming the obstacle of interest-taking without talking about something which I suppose you could describe as meta-halachic, or, if you prefer, a matter of hashkofe, and that is whether any of this is really justifiable. Because what a heterisk does is to take what otherwise would be a prohibited loan agreement, an interest-bearing loan agreement, and convert it into something else, technically at least, although in the real world, I suppose most people would look at this and would say that it's an interest-bearing agreement and that it's just a disguised form of interest. For purposes of American law, it might very well be treated that way, depending upon what type of formula you use for the heteriska. So this seems to be a subterfuge which may conform to the letter of the law, but seems to be designed to evade the spirit of the law. So let me make a general comment. I'll try to be as brief as possible. A general comment with regard to subterfuges, what in rabbinic literature are generally referred to as a haroma, a trick. I prefer a neutral term. I call them devices. A device which is used to avoid the onus or the severity of application of the strict letter of the law. We're all familiar with those, at least in Judaism, and I find that they can be divided into three separate categories. There are categories of, quote, devices, close quote, which Judaism traditionally promotes and encourages. There are other devices which Judaism clearly discourages, abhors, recognizes technically it may be permissible, but it's a kind of a trick which is being used to overcome the letter of the law. And then there's a third category with regard to which Judaism is absolutely neutral. If you want to use it, if you don't want to, you're under no obligation to use it. Let me give you an example of each of those categories, and then we'll talk about a permissible venture or a heteriska as a means of avoiding problems of interest. In the Gemara, we find that people found a way to avoid the obligation of miser, tithing. It's a tax, and it's a pretty expensive business, and everybody tries to evade taxes. And here there's a beautiful loophole that enables you to evade taxes. The rule is that if you bring the produce into the silo, the home, through a front door, it's obligated to everything that halacha requires. If you bring it in through a skylight or through a window, you can manage to avoid all of this. And as early as the Mishnah, we have negative comments about people who take advantage of the loophole. For obvious reasons, what's the purpose of the law? The purpose of the law is to create a leisure class who will be able to fulfill their obligations in terms of the Beis HaMikdash. You have Levim, who have assigned functions. So they're also designed to be a teaching class. And they have to be supported in one way or another. The Meister was designed to support them. And if you're going to find a way to avoid this Meister or tax, then these people are going to go out and have to work in factories, not going to be available to do what they are supposed to be doing. So clearly, what I suppose today we would call public policy, Jewish policy, was not to take advantage of those loopholes because it thwarts the purpose of the halacha. I'll give you another example. You cannot open a collection of tshuvas, or a sponsor collection, that was authored in the 18th or the 19th century without finding one or more responsa dealing with the proper method of transferring title to an animal to a non-Jew. And what is this big problem? The problem is that in those days there were Jewish farmers, and Jewish farmers had cows, and cows calve, and the firstborn of a cow is a bechor. And the bechor has to be taken to the Beis HaMikdash and offered as a sacrifice on the altar. And if you don't have a Beis HaMikdash or you don't take it to the Beis HaMikdash, you have what is literally a holy cow. Everybody knows what the holy cows are in India. They're public nuisances. They treat them as sacred objects. You can't drink them. You can't use them as a beast of burden. And all that the Jewish farmer can do with his cow is let it roam until he hopes one day it will develop a blemish, a mum of one kind or another, and at that point it will no longer be off bounds as far as other benefit is concerned. So what do you do when you're going to be confronted with this kind of a problem? Well, the simple solution is to sell the cow to a non-Jew before it calves, because it's only Jewish cows that have this obligation. Non-Jewish calves don't give birth to non-Jewish cows don't give birth to calves that have kedushas bechor. But if you're going to do this, you have to be very careful, because you have to use a form of kinyan, formal transfer of title, which is valid in transactions between Jews and non-Jews, and the laws of kinyanim for Jews and non-Jews are not necessarily the same as they are between Jews and Jews. We have all kinds of derabbanans, we have rabbinic forms of transfer, and here when you're avoiding a biblical obligation, you better be careful to have a biblically valid form of transfer. So you have all of these tshuvas dealing with before the fact, after the fact, the farmer did it one way, did it the other way. How old was the non-Jew to whom he sold it? Does he reach legal maturity at 13 or earlier than that or later than that? These were all serious problems. But if you look at even a single one of those responses, let alone looking at half a dozen or a collection of them, you discover that this was something that was actively encouraged. If somebody were to go to a rov and say, my cow became pregnant, what should I do? He would immediately say, sell it to a goy, and now we'll figure out what is the proper mode of transfer. And that's, again, an area in which what you're doing certainly defeats the purpose of the basic mitzvah of Kedushas Bechor. The whole point is to sacrifice this in the Beis HaMikdash, and look what this farmer is doing. He's avoiding the obligation. Why do we encourage it? Because the animal does have the sacred character of a sacrificial animal, but you can't offer it in the Beis HaMikdash. The purpose of the halacha, the purpose of the mitzvah cannot be fulfilled, and you're stuck with the technicalities. Here, the avoidance of the problem is an attempt to reconcile the spirit of a halacha with the technicalities that prevent the fulfillment of the mitzvah in a concrete way. So here you have what I call a device, which is not to be abjured. It's not even neutral. It's to be actively promoted. And then we have a third category. The third category, every Jew does, because everybody's involved in this once a year, Erev Pesach, selling chometz to a goy. If you have ever come upon any negative statement with regard to the sale of chometz to the goy, if you read it carefully, it's because of a concern that the parties don't take it seriously. And as anybody familiar with either halacha or common law knows, you need meeting of minds. If you don't have meeting of minds, you don't have gemiras das, you don't have smichus das, you don't have a kinyan. So if this is a sham, and everybody believes it's a sham, you may have an invalid sale. But no one ever raised an objection to the basic concept that if you can have serious people engaging in the transfer of chometz before Pesach, that somehow you are defeating the purpose of the halacha. Now, why is that? Because the Torah never says that you have to destroy every little particle of chometz in your possession. You may have to destroy a minimum quantity, and even that isn't as clear as it might seem. But there is no mitzvah, if you already have a loaf of bread, to go out Erev Pesach and buy a dozen more loaves so that you can burn 12 loaves or 13 loaves instead of one loaf. If you find yourself with a case of single malt scotch, Glatkos
kosher single malt scotch, Erev Pesach, the Torah, in effect, has given you three options. The first option is to drink it all in one sitting, which I do not recommend. The second option is to throw it all into the fire and burn it. And the third option is to divest in favor of a non-Jew. Those are the three ways of avoiding the Isser of Bal Yiro and Bal Yemotzei. Three separate ways of avoiding the problem of only chametz over Pesach. Which of the three is preferable? And the answer is, they're equal. Torah has no preference for one over the other. So this is a device, the sale to a non-Jew, is a device that I put into the neutral category. The Torah hasn't promoted it, and the Torah is not trying to discourage it. It's an option which is available, and at your discretion, you can avail yourself of that. Now we have to talk about the hetrisk. And it's very clear that there is a mitzvah to lend money to people who need funds. One of the relatively few cases where the Torah gives us the rationale underlying a commandment, in the same breath, the same sentence, when the Torah tells us you're not allowed to take interest, the Torah says that, but your brother should live with you, and Rambam, of course, speaks about this at length. A loan is the highest form of tzedakah, it's a form of charity. Instead of embarrassing the person by giving him a handout, you're giving him a loan which he will repay when he is in more comfortable financial circumstances, and in the meantime, this is going to tide him over whatever difficulties he's having. So the Torah has said that lending money is a mitzvah, and lending without interest, because with interest you're simply making life more difficult for the person who is on the receiving end. So any attempt to get a premium in return for the loan and call it by some name other than interest taking seems to be a way of skirting the mitzvah, and on the surface should be a violation of the spirit of halacha, even if somehow you manage to conform with the technicalities. Here I would give you a kind of a hypothetical. Let us assume that we are back in the early 20s, and there's a gentleman by the name of Chaim Ford, not Henry Ford, his name is Chaim Ford. And he's got this bright idea that he can put up a factory in Detroit and mass produce horseless carriages and sell them at a relatively low price, but there's one problem. The problem is that he needs capital. And therefore, he approaches anybody in this room and asks for a loan, a significant amount. Is there an obligation upon any Jew to provide a loan of that nature to this fellow Jew whose name happens to be Chaim Ford? Well, let's throw back for a second. V'cheyochich imoch is a description of a provident loan. And you have to remember that in antiquity, those were the only loans that were around. You weren't living in a capital-intensive society. The ability of money to reproduce asexually is a miracle of the Industrial Revolution. Now, before the Industrial Revolution, that's not how it worked. But suddenly, money is able to make money. And this is a different ballgame. The Torah is saying that if somebody is poor, a farmer's crop has failed, and he doesn't have seeds to plant next year's crop, or there's been some kind of an emergency, and he needs money to put bread on the table, of course, that's called tzedakah. Tzedakah in the form of a loan is a higher form of tzedakah. But if Chaim Ford comes to me, and I presume that Chaim Ford, before he became the proprietor of the Ford Motor Company, was also earning a living in one form or another, scraping by like everybody else was scraping by, and now says, but I have a get-rich-quick scheme, and if you lend me the money, I can become fabulously wealthy. Do I have an obligation to take my capital and give it to him so that he can become wealthy? And the answer is absolutely no. This is not tzedakah. If you're smart, you'll build the factory yourself. Why give the money to Chaim Ford for him to build the factory? There is clearly no mitzvah to lend money to somebody somebody who is already earning a living so that he can become a millionaire on my money or on your money or on somebody else's money. Yet the prohibition against interest taking exists under those circumstances. Under those circumstances, I would submit, there is no prohibition whatsoever in entering into a heter iske, or a permissible venture, in order to avoid the pitfall of the prohibition against interest taking. You have a situation in which the spirit of the halacha does not apply. The technicalities don't follow the spirit. That's axiomatic as far as halacha is concerned. It's an independent world of its own. And you are now confronted by these technicalities which prohibit the taking of interest, and somehow you've got to find the device that will avoid the pitfall of the prohibition. The situation, as everybody recognizes, certainly in this room, Chaim Ford could have raised money in one of two ways. He could ask us for loans and issue bonds in return for those loans, or he can issue common stock. And issuing common stock is a way of having everybody participate in the enterprise. Everybody, in effect, becomes a partner with equity in his venture. Which of the two shall he embark upon? Well, I'm not going to serve as his accountant or his attorney. You know that in some circumstances it makes good economic sense for a company to issue bonds, and other situations it makes better sense for them to issue stock. But basically, either a stock offering or floating bonds on the market is a way of raising capital in order to continue the enterprise to make money. Sure.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Would it refine the analysis at all to think of it as not two choices, but as 20 choices? Could be a revolving loan.
Of course.
Could be a short-term loan.
Of course.
Could be fixed rate, could be
value. Sure.
Could be unsecured. Could be preferred stock. Could be preferred stock.
Absolutely. Right.
Okay.
You can multiply the options almost ad infinitum.
And would that be halakhically helpful?
Well, we would have to examine every one of the proposals to see whether it presents problems insofar as interest taking is concerned. I've purposely set this as a kind of a dichotomy. Everybody recognizes that selling equity is selling a share in the company. You now become a partner, and the risks are borne equally, whereas floating bonds is simply a way of borrowing money. And, of course, you can have things that share in aspects of both of those devices and both of those possible forms that can be used in order to raise capital. Now, this isn't really a new problem by any means, and certainly it wasn't the individual who is now trying to set up a motor factory or anything else that was confronted with this for the very first time. About the earliest form of a formal heter iske, of a device that's designed to have a transaction governed by a venture form rather than by a loan form, is the heter iske of Maram Avigdor sometime in the 16th century. Then the socioeconomic situation was that Jews, traditionally they were traders, they were middlemen, and they went off to a yarid, a fair that was held in regional centers a couple of times a year, and they brought produce, they bought whatever it was, and then they went peddling it through these towns and villages and what have you. And circumstances often became such that a gentleman who was in business decided that it's enough. He doesn't want to do this himself anymore. He'd rather have other people do it for him. And you have young people setting out in business who don't have the capital to do this. Now, this is relatively modest capital, but it's capital nonetheless. And so you have an arrangement that's entered into by these people. The young man who's now setting himself up in business, under other circumstances, would go to his local bank and take a loan and be paying interest. But he doesn't have that option available to him. There's no banking system, number one. Number two, the Jew, even if he were a banker, couldn't lend him money at interest anyway, so you have what becomes a kind of a joint venture. The oldest form of a heter iske had the following character. The financier, I will call him, Mr. Moneybags, the financier who doesn't want to be personally involved in all of this, takes a sum of money and he presents it to another individual who is essentially his commercial agent. And he tells him to go off and buy goods with the money and to sell them, and then to reinvest by buying more goods until he has reaped a profit of 100%, when he's doubled the capital. He's not greedy, this man. All he wants is 100% return on the investment. What's in it for the person who is acting this way? Not the salary. That's important, but it's not why he's doing it. He is doing it because after he realizes the profit that has been anticipated by the financier, he receives an interest-free loan of double the capital that had originally been advanced to him, which he is now free to use on his own account. And he keeps on buying and selling, and a year or whatever the period is later, he goes back and he returns twice the amount of money that he has received from the financier. Now, note the nature how this little arrangement was structured. It was structured so that during the initial period, the person receiving the money was nothing more than a commercial agent. And the money that he received, he was receiving as a kind of a bailment. He is acting on behalf of the principal. He is buying and selling not on his account, but on the account of the principal. And suddenly, on the agreed date, or the date on which he has realized the agreed upon profit, all of this suddenly converts into an interest-free loan, and he can now continue investing on his own accord. Now, there are a number of problems, halakhic problems, and very practical problems with regard to all of this. The crucial difference between an investment or a bailment on the one hand, and those are different, but I'm going to lump them together, and a loan on the other hand is that a loan provides absolute guarantee of capital. The capital, or the face amount of a loan, has to be returned no matter what. Please don't confuse me by talking about bankruptcy. Halacha doesn't know anything about that bankruptcy. It does know about loans being discharged every seventh year. That's entirely different. It does very well know that people may default on loans. Defaulting on a loan means you're not able to pay the sum that you borrowed. But the debt remains a debt. And at least in conscience, you have an obligation to repay. And if you ever win the sweepstakes or a lottery or what have you, you will be called upon to satisfy whatever the obligation was. An investment or a bailment is not a situation in which there is a guaranteed return of capital or a guaranteed liability for return of capital. Depending upon the nature of the investment, the nature of the bailment, there will be situations in which you are not called upon to return whatever has been given to you for safekeeping, for investment, or what have you. Even in the worst of circumstances, with the greatest kind of liability, insofar as the laws of bailment are concerned, force majeure is enough to exonerate the person who's received the bailment. A person borrows money from the bank. On the way home, he's mugged, or highway robbers attack him. He remains liable, and the fact that he had to surrender the money under duress is not going to exonerate him. So the crucial distinction is whether there is absolute liability or whether there isn't absolute liability. The other distinction between an interest-bearing loan and some other arrangement is whether or not there is a guarantee of a return. An interest-bearing loan provides a guarantee, in quotation marks obviously, but at least as far as the obligation is concerned, no matter what happens, whether you make money or you don't make money in the enterprise for which you borrow the money, you're going to have to pay whatever interest you agreed to pay. If you are a commercial agent or acting on behalf of a principal and investing on somebody else's behalf, well, if the mutual fund doesn't make any money 1 year, so they don't declare a dividend. They don't return a dividend to the people who have invested. There has to be the possibility, at least, that there is no guaranteed return. So that in order to find a method or a device that will permit the transfer of funds, there has to be some circumstance in which the capital is exposed, and there cannot be an ironclad guarantee of profit to the person advancing the funds. So in the case of the Heteriska of Marama Vigders that I described, you have a situation in which the investor's funds are exposed during the initial period of this transaction, unless and until it generates profit equal to the amount of capital advanced. It is the investor's funds that are at risk, and if some highway robbers stop the stagecoach and steal, it's going to be his loss, not the loss of the person holding the money. And if somehow the market goes into distress and he cannot dispose of what he has purchased at a profit, there will be no profits to share. By the same token, once it is converted to an interest-free loan, the principal is fully protected, at least in theory, at least in terms of halachic liability. At this point, it's a loan, and it's like every other borrower, and no excuses. Sooner or later, you're going to have to repay all of this. But this wasn't terribly convenient. In addition to everything else, the person who was acting as a commercial agent, we know what his real motive is. His real motive was that he's going to get an interest-free loan in return for his services, and therefore he has to be compensated. And halacha knows about peppercorn theories. The amount of compensation can be de minimis, or at least most rabbinic authorities maintain it can be de minimis. The Gros did not accept the Heter Iska of Maram Avigdor's because he maintained that paying a peppercorn or its equivalent was clearly a subterfuge, and that you have interest in the form of personal services in this person acting as the commercial agent during this initial period of time, and that's enough to invalidate the transaction as a device that can be used in order to avoid the problems. Whether the Gros would have opposed later forms of heter isk or not, I can't talk about in the half hour which has already elapsed. But I think that that's a matter which can be debated, and you can advance arguments pro and con. That's not my problem. Right now, there is a way to avoid that problem totally and completely, even according to the Gros. I don't think we'll have time to talk about it, and it's not described in the material that I gave you. I call it the Heter Iska of B'nai Brak. They avoided the problem totally and completely, and maybe I'll refer to it very briefly if I can continue a little bit. The Heter Iska of Maram Avigdor's gave rise to numerous progeny. The standard Heter Iska, people call it the Huh?
You should, please. I beg you to continue.
No, it's just not good. The Heter Iska of Maram Avigdor's, people call the Heter Iska the Heter Iska of Maram Avigdor's. People have even shown me documents which have a rubber stamp. It's an ordinary loan form. Al pi Heter Iska de Maram. And I just look at it and I say, this can't possibly be what these people meant. I doubt that they would even recognize the Heter Iska of Maram. If you'll ask them what they mean, they will proceed to describe the Heter Iska of the Chochma Zodom. That comes one generation later in terms of the development of the Heter Iska. The Heter Iska of the Chochma Zodom, which is by far the most common form of Heter Iska, is what is generally termed Chatzi Milva Chatzi Pikoton. You give somebody $2,000 and you stipulate that $1,000 is a loan, interest-free, and the other $1,000 is an investment. And the deal is that the funds are supposed to be commingled and invested on behalf of both of these individuals, the one who is retaining title to his $1,000 and the other one who is the recipient of an interest-free loan, and the profits are to be divided equally, at least in theory, so that the financier is getting nothing more than 50% of all profits, which he is genuinely entitled to. The recipient of the funds is also going to be paid for his services in one way or another, not by the interest-free loan, but peppercorn or whatever it is. Now you've got a situation in which the financier is going to get 50% of all profits, and not very many borrowers really want to pay 50% of their profits to the person or the institution that's lending them the money. Typically, that's not how it works. There is nothing that forces the financier to accept 50% of the profits on his investment. In addition to paying the agent a peppercorn, he can agree that in return for his services as an investment agent, he will allow him to keep excess profits, profits over some modest minimum, shall we say 20%? remembering in the back of our minds that 20% of $1,000 is really 10% of $2,000, which isn't so terrible. So he agrees. It's called accord and satisfaction. I'm really entitled to 50% of all profits, but which is 100% of the profits on my share. But out of the goodness of my heart, I will agree to accept a lesser amount, so that if you pay me the lesser amount, we're quit, and I've gotten as much as I want, the rest is yours. Now, we haven't really accomplished what we want to accomplish, because we have accomplished exactly 50% of what we want to accomplish. That is that the principal's funds are only 50% exposed. The recipient is going to have to pay 50% no matter what, because that was a loan. The other 50% was an investment, and if everything goes south, there's nothing to repay. So that you've protected him only 50%, but he wants to be protected totally and completely. How do we protect him? You cannot assume absolute liability, but you can agree to an enhanced level of vigilance in protecting the investment. If the deal is that you're going to buy shmate on the open market and sell it and reinvest the money, ordinarily a person who buys goods is obligated to exercise ordinary normal care, but he doesn't have to stand guard 24 hours a day. He can entrust it to his employees, etc., etc. You can stipulate that he's got to watch it personally 24 hours a day, and that he has to have it in his bedroom under his bed at night because you don't trust it to anybody else. You can create situations which are likely to lead to a breach, and that breach is going to be called negligence. So that if it all goes up in flames through nobody's fault afterwards, this person is going to be held liable. You can do more than that. You can include a clause which says that proof of loss is to be demonstrated only on the basis of two reliable, credible witnesses whose testimony would be acceptable to a Bez Din in accordance with Shulchan Aruch. Now, that excludes 95% of the world at least, because all these non-Jews are not qualified to testify in the Bez Din, and chances of being able to satisfy this are rather scanty, so that you have effectively a guaranteed preservation of the capital. There was one rabbinic authority, the Trumas Hadeshin, who came up with an even more ironclad device. He wanted to stipulate not that any two trustworthy, credible witnesses could testify, but he would name the witnesses who could testify. And he chose the rabbi of the community and was described as the chazan. He didn't mean the chazan, it was the shamus. Whatever. Why? Because these are the two most reliable people in the community? I hope so, but I'm not sure. It's because these are the two people in the community who are least likely to have any knowledge of any particular commercial affair. They're not going to be wandering in the marketplace to see what happened to the goods when they were bought, whether this person exercised proper care, whether he didn't exercise proper care. Net result is that, sure, the money is at risk in theory, because if you have the witnesses and they testify they went up in flames, you lost your money. There's no recourse. But in the real world, it's not going to happen. But this doesn't yet guarantee a return on the investment. And even more significant, the original heteriska provided no reason why the recipient of the fund should not procrastinate and be tardy in returning the capital as well as the profit. Remember, this is an interest-free loan. The longer he keeps it, the longer he can buy and sell on his own account, the more money he's making. So he agreed to return it in a year. And if he didn't, what are you going to do? You'll bring it to Besden. You'll have protracted proceedings. And in the meantime, you got another 3 months minimum. What do you do to make sure that if he keeps the money longer, at least your profits go up over this period of time? Once you have the heter iska, the chokhmas odom, you stipulate in terms of the accord and satisfaction, in terms of the amount you're going to accept, in lieu of 50% of all profits, that there is the anticipation that you will earn, shall we say, 20% per annum. And you'll prorate on a monthly, weekly, daily basis, do it any way you like. And that's reasonable, because the longer you have the money, the longer you can buy and sell, the longer you can trade on the market, the longer you can do whatever you want with the money, the more investment opportunities you have, and it's only fair that the financier share in those profits. But How do you guarantee that you're going to get a dividend when there are no profits? And remember that in the world in which we live, people who extend their funds this way don't want the excuse that the business didn't do very well this year. They want a, quote, guaranteed return on the investment. A guaranteed return we cannot give them, but we can do second best. And you rate situations in which there is a reasonable anticipation that the funds representing the profit, the dividend, will be forthcoming. And that is to provide, ordinarily burden of proof is on the plaintiff. I advance the money. I claim that you invested, you made money. I've got to prove it. And if you say no profit, no dividend, burden of proof is on me. But you can switch the burden of proof. You can agree that there is a presumption that money has been made, and you have to be able to rebut it. If you can't rebut it, then it's, again, a guaranteed return, which is called interest, and if there's promise of interest, a guarantee of interest, this is called an interest-bearing loan, whatever you may choose to call it. Remember, the IRS says there's no such thing as interest-free loan. Well, unless you structure it properly, halacha says the same thing. If it looks like a duck, and it walks like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck, no matter what you call it. If it's got protection of capital and guaranteed return, you can call it whatever you like. Halacha calls it a loan. So how do you guarantee that this person is going to pay you even when there is no profit? And that is, you can't demand witnesses that there was no profit. There's witnesses to a non-event. That doesn't make very much sense. You can demand witnesses that it was consumed by flames. Yes, that's an event. But how can you ever prove that somebody didn't earn money in one way or another? The only way that you can satisfy that burden is with an oath. And that's why every heter comes with a stipulation that a certain amount is to be paid as dividend that have been earned by the funds that have been invested. These funds have been commingled and invested on the part of both financier and recipient. He's entitled to 50% and to whatever he's agreed to in lieu of the 50%. And he's got to prove that there were no dividends by means of a solemn oath. This works only because two categories of people who don't take oaths, Jews and Quakers. It was assumed that no Jew will swear such an oath. I can't vouch for the veracity of the story. Maybe it's apocryphal. I prefer to think it isn't. But the legend is that the wealth of the house of Rothschild stemmed from an incident involving the patriarch of the family, whose name was Anshul Rothschild. Anshul Rothschild was a poor shamus someplace, and some wayfarer deposited money with him over Shabbos, and when it came after Abdul, he wanted his money back. The money was gone. And he finds himself hauled before the local Rav, and the Rav decides that he's obligated in a Shuvas Hashemri. He had accepted a bailment, now he has to swear that it was stolen from him. But Anshul Rothschild will not take an oath, even if it was to the truth. And as a result, he slaved the rest of his life to repay the money he borrowed to compensate this person whose money had been stolen, and as a result, he and his descendants became fabulously wealthy. Post hoc ergo propter hoc, and of course the story has it that this was the direct compensation, the schar, for having refused to take an oath. Now the whole notion of a heter iska is predicated on the presumption that the recipient of the funds is not going to swear even to the truth, which means that to all intents and purposes not only is the capital preserved, guaranteed, but there is a kind of a quasi-guarantee that there will be a dividend as well. Are there other ways to assure that the person will pay the dividend rather than a claim that he has taken a loss? Yeah?
Where someone has taken the oath, though?
I have never personally been involved in any such situation.
There was a situation once in the basin when the person said he's ready, willing, and able to swear, and you made everything at the last moment, you know, when you were really ready to do it, you know, there's a whole procedure that you do, how you perform it, and when we saw that he's about to do it, we stopped it.
Right.
I thought this is all in confidence.
I have never heard of a Besdin actually administering the oath, and in the case of a Heter Iska, there are other ways to prevent the need for the oath. Again, it may not work in mass money lending, but generally, if a person were ever to invoke the provisions of a Heter Iska and demand the prerogative of taking an oath, I don't think he would remain in business very long, because nobody would ever give him credit again. That's probably the strongest economic sanctions available. But yes, it is definitely the case that it's a possibility. I think the fact that Rabbi Cohn does not recall any situation in which it was imposed in the case of a Heter Iska is a pretty good indication that as a practical matter, the Heter Iska works as a device. Now, let me just talk very briefly about one of the complications. In fact, even more than briefly, the Heter Iska I referred to that I called the Heter Iska B'nai Brak. It goes a step further. Instead of having the funds delivered 50% loan, 50% bailment, which gives you problems with regard to what happens with the dividends on the loan, or the dividends on the bailment that are compensate for no profit on the loan, they generated an instrument that provides for kulei pekodin. It's all a bailment. And therefore, whatever you are returning as dividends on the capital that belongs to the financier. There's never been any loan at all, only this is a bona fide business transaction, and the financier has agreed to a limited return on his investment, comparable to preferred stock, if you like, where you're going to get only a limited return on an investment. Your money is at risk. You're going to get a return, but you're going to get a limited return. Everything else is going to go to the other partners in the enterprise. In this case, everything else is going to go not to the partners of the enterprise, since there are no other partners, but it's going to go to the commercial agent as a fee for his services. The real problem with a Heter Iska, and remember that this Heter Iska that I am describing is intended only for bona fide commercial enterprises. And what is a bona fide commercial enterprise, and what is a provident loan? No time to talk about. I think I tried to discuss it in the materials I distributed. It doesn't necessarily include lending somebody money because he's on the verge of a wedding for one of his children or something of the sort. But bona fide commercial loans certainly don't violate the spirit of the halacha. Whether others do or not is a matter of considerable discussion in contemporary poskim. Now, this device is a device that guarantees return of dividends because it has a provision for an oath in lieu of payment of the dividend. However, in circumstances in which the financier is not entitled as a matter of halacha to demand an oath, it's not going to work. Because if you can't demand an oath, then the person turns around and says, there was no profit. You cannot demand an oath to facts which you already know. That creates problems when you have, quote, loan agreements, close quote, which do not involve a transfer of funds. Margin accounts, purchase money mortgages is probably the best example. The seller hasn't gotten any money. The seller is now getting periodic payments which cover more than the price of the house because you're factoring in the interest payment as well. And you can construe, at least until the last couple of weeks, you could construe the purchase of any real estate, including a residence, as a commercial enterprise, because everybody knows that all real estate goes up in value. It never goes down. This is an anomaly. We know that. So that if you're not paying me cash up front, why shouldn't I, the seller, be entitled to participate in the enhancement of value of the house during the period in which you've been holding my money? But then what happens?
happens when, what happened the last couple of weeks, the bottom falls out of the real estate market and I know that the house isn't worth any more than it was before. I can no longer accept funds in lieu of a note because I know very well that even if you sold the house, you weren't going to make any money. There's no money to be made here. The same is true in the margin account. The broker knows very well that no funds were released to the customer. They went to buy the stock, and he's holding the stock in escrow. He knows the customer couldn't have sold the stock, and knows the stock went down. So how can he charge interest for all of this? That's a serious problem. And I confronted it the first time when somebody who was a principal of an investment brokerage house asked me for a heter iska, and it took me for a while to find a way to deal with this. And lo and behold, I found precedent. There is a way of dealing with this, and that is that you can draft an agreement which is quite different from the classic heter iska that has been around for a long time, and that is that you create a chatzi mil v'chatzi pikodin by obligating the client to take funds of his own and to invest them on behalf of himself as well as on behalf of whoever is accepting a purchase of a mortgage or is opening the margin account or what have you, so that they both parties now become partners, not only the margin account or in the house, but in all these other investments out there. The presumption being that either, yes, he has other investments and the financier is entitled to be a partner in those, or that he is not going to do this, and if he could prove that he hadn't done it, he wouldn't be liable for anything because there was no investment, there were no dividends, but he would have to establish that on the basis of the solemn oath, which he's not about to take. And since he's not about to take the solemn oath, he will pay the fee in lieu of the dividend payment. It's important to recognize that the heter iska, the permissible venture agreement, sets up a mechanism that provides A, for dividends, and B, when there are no dividends, a payment which is not interest, not dividends, but is a fee in lieu of the oath. It's payment for being released from the obligation to take the oath, and that's perfectly legitimate. A person who's obligated to take an oath can buy out of this agreement by offering a stipulated amount of money, and that is precisely what this is designed to do. I've spoken much longer than I should have.
Annually?
I'm sorry?
That would be done monthly, annually?
The accord and satisfaction can be done on a periodic basis as agreed by the parties.
Uh-huh.
You are going to pay me in a timely manner,
right,
and I want the money on the due date, and if you're not going to pay me the money on the due date, I want an oath on that date to the effect that there was no profit up until this particular point in time. You're entitled to receive a check at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Next month, you may make scads of money, but that's not going to satisfy what he owed me for the past.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I apologize. I spoke much too long, and the material and the technicalities are much too complicated to try to speak about so quickly. But I presume that this is only the first step. Where's Rabbi Cohn? And that Rabbi Cohn is going to conduct additional seminars to flesh out all of these things.
Yes. Great question.
Are there any questions while we're waiting for Rabbi Cohn?
I'm not sure what distinction you were getting at in the case of a purchase money mortgage or a margin account, but I do want to ask, maybe this will clarify. In the case of a purchase money mortgage, you could have a seller who has a negotiable instrument who can sell the note that he takes from the buyer, in which case, from the seller's point of view, it's exactly the same as advancing funds. In other words, he gets a note from the buyer, he sells the note to a third party, he has the funds from the sale immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder whether there's a difference
negotiable
and non-negotiable.
Yes, negotiable instruments create a totally different ball game.
Okay.
And that you haven't avoided the interest problems.
I wouldn't have thought so.
No. But I can tell you how to avoid them in a different way. Without it, you don't even need a heter iska. Typically, I would imagine that if you're going to give a seller a negotiable instrument, you have been negotiating, he wants $100,000 for his house, cheap house. But if you're going to give him cash, that's all he wants. If you're going to give him a negotiable instrument, which he has to go and discount in the bank or wherever, he wants $110,000. Now there's a difference. Because you're saying that there's one price for cash and there's another price for credit. That is a form of interest. It's rabbinic interest, but it's interest. Now, there is one way to avoid all of this, but you've got to be very sophisticated for it. And it works best in the situation of some middle-aged, elderly individual who now wants to retire to Florida. And the last thing in the world that he wants is for somebody to give him $100,000. Because he takes that to the bank, he gets at best 5% interest. If he gets a purchase money mortgage, he's going to get a return of 6 or 7% interest. That's what he really wants. Because he can't invest and get 7%. The person who is buying the house and is getting a purchase money mortgage is happy to pay 7% because he goes to a lending company, he's going to pay 8%, whatever. The way for these people to do it is for the seller to sit down with a straight face and say, I'm happy to sell for cash, but my price, cash and purchase money mortgage, is the same. And that's because I need this money to live on in Florida. Therefore, you take you've got the option. You want to pay me cash up front, but the cost is $110,000, whatever it's going to be. Or I shouldn't even say $110,000, but you will figure out what the interest is going to be over the lifetime of the purchase money mortgage. Either you pay me all of that discounted by 5% I can get in the bank, or you give me the purchase money mortgage, but don't say discounted by the amount I can get in the bank, because that already involves me in an interest problem. So I've got to tell you, I have figured out for myself what I want for this property, and how I arrive at that figure is nobody's business. But you're going to get the same price whether it's a purchase money mortgage or cash. And you know what the purchaser is going to do. The purchaser, of course, is going to take the purchase money mortgage rather than paying it all up front. He'd be foolish to pay it all up front. Or he wouldn't be a very clever businessman if he paid it all up front. But you see, that's how you would have to do this rather than the negotiable instrument scenario. But the typical purchase money mortgage is not where you give a negotiable instrument in return, but you're holding the mortgage and you want to make periodic payments on the mortgage. There are other ways to avoid it. I've got a form, a device, another kind of device for avoiding it.
With a margin account, this is a related question. The brokerage house holds the securities in the account as collateral for the loan.
Right.
Does it matter what the brokerage house does with the collateral? Because
not really.
It doesn't.
No, because as far as their loan agreement with the customer is concerned, they know that the customer has had a loss. And they know that there's nothing to demand an oath for. You're asking me to swear to confirm something you already know. That's called a shvuas shov. A vain oath, not a false oath. A vain oath, which is designed to accomplish no real purpose, is prohibited as a matter of law, and you can't enforce it.
Thank you.
No, I'm sorry.
You shouldn't be sorry at all. I'm very thankful.
But it's also
secure.
Good.
Right.
What if you come across, you know, a situation, because it has to do with Jewish people, even if they're not.
Right.
And they.
That's a problem I referred to before. Now, perjury doesn't mean very much to them, and they might just be ready and willing to perjure themselves. Mm-hmm. That's a serious problem. In an article that I referred to in the material I distributed, the late Rabbi Shiloh Raphael came up with a really interesting idea. You put in a clause saying that somebody claims he didn't earn a profit on the investment, that he has to open his books. He presumed that nobody would allow you to inspect his books, and therefore would be more than happy to satisfy the underlying obligation by paying the dividend in lieu of opening the books. The short answer to your question is that if you're really concerned that this person is going to swear an oath, you're not protected. But stipulate, there's going to be an oath in Beis Din in accordance with Shulchan Aruch, and I will be willing to bet or take odds that even a secular individual isn't going to swear by the time the Beis Din is finished with it.
That's probably a common situation,
so they get there. Remember, we're making it a lot more difficult than signing a piece of paper, an affidavit under penalty of perjury. That people do every day of the week, and they don't take it seriously. Beis Din oaths, even a secular Jew will take seriously, I assure you.
Good to know.
No, I think so.
Okay.
Fine. Anybody have questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you very, very much. No, borrow money with interest, but can't lend money with interest for technical reasons, and I think that the weight of authority is contrary to his position. But again, that's for another seminar. That's not for tonight. Corporations are a serious problem, not only in the world of finance, but in the world of mechiras chametz. The form of sale that I use, Erev Pesach, includes the sale of shares in any corporation that may have assets in chametz. And I inform the non-Jew that he has the right to exercise the option of buying the share, or taking title to the shares, as of the closing price of the market the day before the mechiras chametz.
If it goes up enough.
Yes, I am exposed. You know, my people are exposed. They'll sue me.
Do they hedge the sale?
Sorry?
I understand if you need to leave us in doubt on this, but if you make a deposit at a commercial bank, you are a creditor of the bank under state law.
Yes, absolutely.
To the bank.
Yes,
okay. Right. So we might all want to know, since probably most people in this room make deposits in banks, mm-hmm. whether there is a halachic issue presented.
There is a halachic issue. It doesn't mean that it's not insurmountable. If it's a Jewish bank with a valid heteriska, problems got to disappear. If it's a non-Jewish bank and the Jewish shareholders individually have not contributed even a de minimis portion of the funds that I am borrowing, or are not the recipients of even a de minimis amount of the funds that I am depositing in the bank, there may not be any problem. The de minimis here is the value of a pruta, which is very, very small. There are other discussions in the responsa literature which indicate that since, under most of these circumstances, we are dealing with kind of interest taking that is probably only rabbinically proscribed, not biblically proscribed, there is the notion of breira, which, do I have to define it in 25 words or less? Breira is an indeterminate act that is subsequently rendered determinate by some empirical condition. Now, that sounds like gobbledygook. But what it means is that I'm doing something which is really indeterminate, only now, for legal purposes, we want it to become determined in one way or another. The determination here is that my funds have been lent to non-Jews rather than to Jews. My funds have been borrowed by the non-Jews rather than the Jews. And the Jews have been borrowing funds and lending funds of non-Jews instead of Jewish funds. And that is one method that has been used to solve this problem. Maybe I should stop. You know, there, because the status of corporations in Jewish law is certainly a topic that should be explored and could easily take an hour to talk about.
Thank you.
For stopping.
No.